All right, everybody, welcome to another episode of Liberty Lands. I am your host, Big John, joined once again this week by the ever-present, ever-knowledgeable, and ever-charming Mr. Mike Termott. Mike, how are you doing today?
Unable to live up to all that, but I'm very well and very glad to be with you and glad to be with you talking about transactions today, some of which do seem to be possibly more narrowly focused than you and I, having known each other the past few years. I think we have a more robust relationship than some of the partners in some of these deals we're talking about.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Let's dive right into it, because I think at the heart of it, I think both you and I enjoy talking about economic matters and deal making and just money issues in general, financial issues and just financial and economic well-being. So let's dive right into it. I think the first thing we need to talk about is what sent most world markets into a positive boost this week, which was over the weekend. The Trump administration announced that they had reached a pause and a deal of sorts in their trade war with China. They announced, just to give you the high points, Mike, and then I want you to address them, meeting in Geneva, Treasury Secretary Bessent and Chinese Vice Premier Li Feng met. They agreed to a 90-day mutual reduction in tariffs. The total U.S. tariffs was reduced to a total of 40% as an effective rate, and Chinese tariffs on U.S. goods got knocked down to 10. So this reduces really the unsustainable tariff levels that were in place, with U.S. tariffs being at 145% on Chinese goods and Chinese retaliatory tariffs at 125%. And we had several issues during the week of small businesses, MAGA-supporting businesses, saying, we're out of business. Austin Peterson famously went to Twitter to say, I had to shut down my shoe business because I just can't afford these tariffs at this point, and I did not vote for this, Mr. President. So we have that issue.
Yeah.
So let's start off with that before we get in too much deeper. Do you think that this pause, A, was it a good thing or not? And B, will it lead to a more permanent trade agreement between the U.S. and China?
Yeah, well, first of all, it was a good thing. I think that the big signal it sends is that we were in a very bad place, because where we are right now, technically, with regard to the tariffs, is actually worse off than when the Trump administration started, and
yes,
yet markets are loving it, mostly because we're getting rid of so much that had gone wrong
right between
January and today. And so markets are very hopeful that there will be a deal done. It's not that markets are so excited about the great spot that we're in now, but that they believe that a deal is coming. By the way, big shout out to Austin Peterson. I'm a bit of an Austin Peterson fan, notwithstanding arguments that we've had in the past. I think he's a good guy and a liberty chaser. And I was saddened to hear that he's having business difficulties. Of course he is. Businesses all over the United States are, that rely to any extent on imports. And so that's a very bad thing. And we're hoping that his business and the thousands of others around the United States that are affected will rebound. We'll figure out a way through here. One of the things worth mentioning is that these things don't happen instantaneously, right? It takes months to physically import something from China, for example, not so from, you know, Mexico and Canada, but it can take months to arrange the deals, however,
even if it were
from Canada or Mexico, but just physically transporting something, never mind the months it might take to cut a deal, it can take months to physically transport something. So when you announce a big tariff, we were at, what, 145% against China, that means no more orders right now for many companies. I suppose there are companies, I suppose you could find an example of someone who needs a product so badly and can make such a margin on it, they're willing to pay a price that's, you know, in effect 2.5 times what they would have otherwise paid had there been no tariffs. But for the most part, that's just a shutdown. when you shut that down, it means to start it back up, you've got to place the orders. Maybe they need to be renegotiated. Maybe your supplier went out of business. There are all kinds of bad things happening. Maybe you cut a deal with someone domestically. Now you've got to unwind that. This is not an easy position to be in. Many companies are not able to just say, oh, you know, we're going to reverse the decision that we made a few weeks ago. No, that's not how this works.
Right.
And so I feel badly for the people who are stuck in the boomerang effect of these reversals. It's not easy. So yeah, where we are is this huge reduction in tariffs at the moment, planning on a deal being cut. But it is important to mention that while it is true that China got rid of their retaliatory tariffs, they have not said anything publicly that would lead you to believe that they're going to take the steps that our government wants them to take, that everyone in the United States needs them to take with regard to protecting the intellectual property of Americans, for example. That's a big deal. The other non-tariff trade barriers, whether that's weird regulatory effects, inspection effects, what happens in many, many, many cases is that if you want to do business in China, you have to relinquish your technology. You need to agree to a Communist Party inspector on how business is done. This is what we mean by the loss of intellectual property. It's not merely, you know, a compromise on a patent. It's not just piracy on the internet. In many cases, it's much tougher than that. It's having the party and the government inspecting your business, stealing your technology right in front of you, not in a cloak and dagger kind of way, not in a way that you don't see. They just, you know, negotiate for you to hand over your process technology, your product technology, in some cases, intellectual property that would be protected here in the United States. But in many cases, it's just a matter of teach us how to do this so that we can compete our way to force you out of business if we should ever want to do so. And this is what puts China in such a strong position in the possibility of a conflict. In other words, if we were to decouple, there are many analysts who believe that a decoupling would leave China in actually a better position than the United States, because China is extracting this technology from us that would allow them to replace us,
right?
Whereas us decoupling from them means, in many cases, rebuilding certain capabilities in the United States, where it's just so much more expensive to do so. So it's a very tricky situation about which the markets are optimistic. I think that we should be optimistic. I think the White House has to cut a deal with China now, or it would just look horrible. By the way, the leverage that we do have over the Chinese government is their economy has not been strong up until now and is even not stronger more, not strong further, not strong in a cataclysmic way because of the potential loss of trade with the United States. They are desperately trying to cut deals around the world. Good for them on some level. You know, we all appreciate the effort. But just like U.S. companies cannot change on a dime, neither can Chinese companies.
Right. And it's still worth noting that for all the doom and gloom coming out of the White House especially, it's important to note, because I don't know that a lot of people rank and file understand this, Mike, the U.S. economy is still 3 to 4 times larger than the Chinese economy. The idea that the U.S. economy is somehow being threatened on a very visceral level by the Chinese economy is just false, in my opinion, right? It's just not true. So while I appreciate that the Trump administration might say, hey, there are legitimate reasons why we don't think China's playing fair, I get that. It is still, again, I sound like a broken record, but I don't mind sounding like a broken record when it's a Milton Friedman tune. We still hurt ourselves more with these tariffs. We still hurt ourselves more with these trade wars that are unnecessary than the damage we inflict on our target, in this case, China or Canada or Mexico. So I think it's very important because I think a lot of people are like, wow, China's nipping on our heels economically, and that's just not the case. The next four economies, the U.S. is number one, the next four add up to the U.S. economy. So that would be China, Japan, Germany, whoever else it is. Yeah. You put them all together, they may add up to the U.S., but any one of them is so far behind us that we really do take a posture of a bully when we pursue these
efforts. Well, I think that that's true. Now, there are plenty of folks in the United States who don't have a problem with the United States acting like a bully. The reason being a bully is problematic is not just because it's a bad look, but because it inhibits and discourages others from doing business with us in the future. We want to appear and we want to be the type of trading partner that is all about free markets so that people feel comfortable doing business with us. And then we need to back that up by the rule of law. And that is something that we have been good at in the past, and we need to maintain adherence to those principles going forward. One of the things I don't think most Americans realize is that China is not a wealthy nation on a per capita basis. They're a big country, right, with over a billion people, and we have a third of a billion people. So there's a huge difference there. But on a per capita income basis, we are still more than six times as wealthy as people living in China. You know, you're talking about the difference between an average GDP of over 80,000 versus one that is more like $16,000 per year. And even if you were to adjust that for purchasing power parity, which is to say things are cheaper in China, you can buy more of it than you can if you were living in the United States. You know, that deserves an adjustment. But still, people in the United States live with an effective income that is triple per head what you would find in China. So having said that, the Chinese government is still working with a huge economy, a huge population, is therefore able to extract large amounts of money to drive a big government, to drive a big military, and this is what makes them dangerous, because they can, if they could wage a military conflict without worrying about democratic processes, and even potentially without feeling the political impact of undermining their economy. So this is really a problem, and we've left ourselves too exposed in Taiwan. And that's what really needs to be unwound, not because we couldn't defeat China in a war, but, you know, doing so would be expensive in every way imaginable and in several ways that are virtually unimaginable. And so that is to be avoided, going to war with a nuclear power like China over microchips.
No, I agree with you. And so when we look at this now, we said the stock markets around the world got a bump
when
this was announced. Do you feel that if this pause is maintained, say beyond the 90 days, or even within that 3-month period, at the levels they're at, assuming no further improvement, do you think that's enough to stave off a recession, or do you think we're still teetering on that?
I think we're still teetering. I think that we need a deal to make the markets feel better, and that's for a couple of different reasons. One is that we do have tariffs in place during this pause that are worse than where we started, right? Yeah. That's number one, and that matters. But there's an imagery, there's a political problem with not cutting a deal. If we don't cut a deal, it implies that larger tariffs are always possible to come back. And therefore, it implies that long-term decisions involving international trade with China, do you really want to go down that path all over again? The old adage of, you know, fool me once, shame on you, right?
Right.
And I think a lot of people would be hesitant to come back to those pre-Trump agreements and relationships.
Yeah, so if I could sum it up, it's just that if we don't get something finalized beyond this temporary pause, it just increases that uncertainty again. And unfortunately, you do have these small business owners, and we mentioned Austin Peterson as an example. You know, these are people that have real-world consequences politically for the president with midterms coming up, and for the Republicans with midterms coming up, that a lot of folks who were snookered into thinking that tariffs would only affect the targets and not U.S. citizens, I think when they see their businesses failing, when they've had to shut down their businesses, or their monthly bills do increase, because alternately now we're seeing that I saw J.D. Vance claim this. Someone asked him about the inflation. He said, well, we're still dealing with Biden's economy, you know, whereas 2 months ago, it's see how well we're doing now that we got rid of Joe Biden.
Yeah, there's only so long you can blame things on Joe Biden. And, you know, I'm all for finding a decent scapegoat and running right. with it. But at some point, rationality has to set in. And, you know, we're into a series of events now that the president is driving on some level, good for him, with this trip all over the Middle East. I think that there is a lot of good things happening. He is a deal maker by nature. He is a deal maker by choice. And so there is some good news out there and some indication that he probably will, or at least wants to develop a good deal with China.
Right, right. And I think one of the things that, I don't know if giving him credit for this is called credit, should be called credit or not, but one of the things I've always said about him is he at heart and in essence, he is a populist. So once he sees the people turn against him, he like there's no such thing as a principled decision on the part of the president. So tariffs are great until his base starts saying, we lost our businesses. We can't afford food on the table anymore, no matter what you're telling me. And I think there was a lot of that leading up to this weekend. I think a lot of his maybe advisors were like, wait a second, you may have told them to prepare for some hard times, but they're not buying it anymore. So
I agree with you.
Some of that.
The reason I am so upset all the time about the bad staff work that the president gets is the absence of principles, not in the context of ethics, which, you know, as libertarians, that does drive us crazy, right?
Right.
We wish that everyone would adhere to a certain ethical set of principles. But
right.
just in a matter of economics, we wish that they would adhere to principles that make more sense. Things like, you know, getting rid of tax, both in terms of volume and types of tax. In other words, getting rid of tariffs, maintaining separation from the Federal Reserve, not accepting gifts from governments around the world. There are certain principles that one might point to and say they're ethical problems, but I do believe in the big picture, we need to focus on the fact that they have real economic efficiency problems that we need to talk our way through.
Right, absolutely. And thank you for the segue. Let's talk about some of these gifts coming in from various nations around the world. The biggest one, and there's several, perhaps, that fall into this category, but the one that's making the rounds is reports that President Trump will be accepting a Qatar-gifted jet to serve as a temporary Air Force One while we upgrade Air Force One and Air Force Two.
Yep.
And basically, this would be a Boeing 747 from Qatar. Now, this was immediately flagged, right? A lot of the president's opponents would said, hey, this smells a lot like a bribe. You know, it's in violation of the emoluments clause. The president's response was, that's fake news because, in essence, what I'm doing is I got Qatar to fund the bill for me to fly around while we upgrade Air Force One. What's wrong with that? I save the American people money. FYI, once we do get our own Air Force One back, this plane will be donated to me when I leave office. So I don't know, Mike, if it's that I'm too much of a Trump TDS sufferer, or if this actually smells like the appearance of impropriety, if nothing else. A lot of folks are saying, hey, this is him cutting a deal. This is him. This is a deal maker. Tell me about this. How do you see this?
I think that there's a lot of smoke and a lot of dopiness. And I think that the best way to characterize this is something that's really, really, really dumb. And the president is going to have to unwind his way out of this for a couple of different reasons. And I appreciate why it's difficult. First, let's talk about the deal itself. No, you cannot take an airplane for your own personal use once you leave office. Right. Once you leave the White House, you're no longer a public employee. You're going to take the airplane because that was the arrangement with the Qatari government. No, that is that's the most obvious piece. Right. Of that. Just it can't fly. Now, I do appreciate the fact that it's hard to financially bribe a billionaire. I don't mean to suggest, you know, a $400 million airplane is going to turn the head of, you know, the president of the United States, who's personally worth billions of dollars, and all of a sudden he's going to make decisions that are no longer in interest of the American people. I get why people would, you know, push back against that argument, because I agree. I don't think that that's going to fly.
Yeah.
But consider the following, and I think I shared a piece of this idea with you earlier. Some guy gives your woman a pearl necklace and matching pearl earrings. What is the appropriate reaction? But I don't want to hear any other I don't want to hear plan. I don't know what plan B is.
Right.
Plan A is you drop that SOB like a sack of potatoes, and after he hits the floor, you say, "So, what's up with the gifts to my girl?" Right?
Right.
That's it. There is no plan. I don't want to hear what the alternative is.
Right.
Right? I do not walk into that conversation saying, "What's up?" No. You break his nose first, and then you ask, "What's up?" And this is why Congress and the American people are having a problem, because I'm not suggesting our girl did anything wrong. I'm not suggesting Donald Trump is going to do anything wrong. I don't like someone else giving our people a big gift, because it does come with strings attached. It just does. There is no such thing as, you know, a gift that size without expecting something in return.
Okay, Mike. So that was a pretty good, vivid description of why it's inappropriate for Qatar to hand us a couple of $100 million worth of a plane. But aside from that, contextually, in terms of what it means in terms of diplomacy and government,
sure.
Hit me up.
There are a couple of complicating factors. Even if you were to believe that Donald Trump is not going to have his head turned, it does open up the idea that in the future, a government, maybe not Qatar, maybe somebody else, is going to, you know, give something, maybe not to Trump, maybe to somebody else. You get where this is going. Once the horse is out of that barn, it might be hard to get it back in. And by the way, it is illegal, right? It is run against the Constitution. And for that reason alone, we should be saying this is not a good idea, even if we were to convince ourselves that in this particular circumstance, it's not that big a deal. Now, let's talk about the deal itself just for a moment.
Sure.
I think it's important for people to realize that there's really not a lot of value in it for the American people.
Right.
For starters, we already have two 747s operating as Air Force One. To listen to the press talk about it, there's this gaping hole that needs to be filled. That's not the case, right? There's two airplanes. They're getting long in the tooth. They're getting old. The refurbishment costs are substantial, and nobody likes to be flying on an airplane that's too old, especially these days. So I get all of that, but it's just not true that it's a ticking time bomb. We could stretch out the operational life of each of these two airplanes to such an extent that waiting for something to be delivered to replace them is absolutely a viable option. Having right. said that, they're already on order. Boeing is already developing an airplane to replace the two that the government owns as Air Force One. The problem is that Boeing is running behind schedule. It's turning out to be even more technically difficult and expensive relative to what original expectations were. And that's where this concept comes from, that there's a gap that needs to be filled. It's just a gap between when we thought we were going to retire these old planes and when the new one would come online. Right. It looks like there's going to be a gap there, but we could stretch out the operational life of the planes that we have. Now, having said that, that would be expensive, but compared to what? Right. You know, folks say that the airplane that the Qataris want to give us is worth $400 million. Okay, fine. What's it going to take to turn that into something that the government would be comfortable calling Air Force One? A lot. There are those who say it would be over $1 billion. I frankly find that hard to believe. But it would be a lot of money, whether it were a billion or not. Right. It would be on the same order of magnitude of the value of the airplane itself. And for what? For a year of use? 2 years at the most, by the way, is what people are saying. Possibly for 0 years.
Right.
It's not a long time that this expense would deliver value to the American people. And so it's probably not a great deal. I think that this deal, for all of the political highlight, it's a bit of a nothing burger in terms of the value to the American people. So we need to be careful about overinterpreting. Now, one more piece of context.
Sure.
Yeah. Because I think this matters. And I think that this is actually how we got here, is that the Trump administration and the Qatari government have been developing a trade and investment deal.
Right.
The Qataris are buying something like 200 airplanes from Boeing. That is not a huge order. That's a colossal order, right? That's like changing the economic life of the state of Washington huge. This matters. And right. I don't want to accidentally sound like it doesn't, right? Frequently, I'm not a big fan of, you know, the government cutting deals on behalf of private companies. It leads to inefficiencies. It leads to corruption. It leads to bribes. It leads to political reversal. What happens when, you know, the next president comes in and says, oh, that was Trump. That's crap. I can cut a better deal and the whole thing melts down. You don't want that either, right? There are all kinds of reasons why you don't want your government involved with some of these deals. But having said that, this order is huge. You know, it's enough. We're not for the fact that we're libertarians and we're stuck on our stupid principles and ethics. One of the things that we really should be talking about is
right.
You know, good for the White House for developing this relationship. Now, that also leads to other criticism. There are all kinds of people who say, well, airplane that the Qataris own, that was purchased with the same pool of money that has been used to foster terrorism around the world. Blood on their hands, including American blood on their hands. That is not a country from whom we should be accepting a gift. I think that's probably a pretty good argument, by the way. But I do think that by the same token, on the other side of that same coin is, okay, that's a government that we want to influence to behave better in the future. And one of the ways to do that is send the President of the United States over, tell him to cut it the hell out. And in exchange for better behavior in the future, we're going to develop a stronger financial relationship.
Now,
I get that.
I see that, Mike. But to your point as well, knowing a thing or two about behavior modification, if you use a bribe instead of a reward to modify behavior, it usually fails. It almost always fails, right? You want to reward good behavior. You don't want to bribe for good behavior or for desired behavior, I should say. So in this particular case, as you were describing it, the first thing that popped in my head is kickback, because it is so similar to like my days on Wall Street when I'd have a vendor come in and say, you know, I've got this new backup rack. You guys are going to love it. It'll only cost you $1 million. And by the way, once we sign this deal, I have the authority to gift you a vacation to the DR, or how would you like to fly to our London office to inspect the facilities type of thing for 2 weeks with your significant other.
Right, the 3-hour inspection that you and your wife are going to go over and spend 4 days planning for.
Yeah, which happens to be right next to a Michelin 5-star restaurant. So you get where I'm going with that.
That's never happened in the Defense Department. That's never happened at Boeing headquarters.
So my sort of question, again, to reinforce what you said earlier, is this do you think that this came from more from Trump himself, like this is a deal that I need to cut? Or, again, do you feel it's bad advice in the sense that I almost find it implausible to think that everyone surrounding his inner circle, the president, said no one could ever possibly interpret this as being a bribe. No one could ever think that this is in violation of the Emoluments Clause. Like, is there no one around him with any actual understanding of what's going on?
I share your frustration, and it's a frustration that you and I share every week.
Yeah, I know.
I just think he gets bad staff work. I don't think that they're all idiots. By the way, there are a couple who are, but they're not all idiots.
Right.
But they seem to be uniformly without sufficient voice. And that's on the president. You know, the president needs to do a better job of giving those people voice, because you know, I can imagine, I don't know how the deal went, but you could easily imagine the conversation of, you know, the government, the Qataris saying, you know, we're willing to make this kind of purchase, and he expresses his gratitude, and there's some other elements to it, and he's asking them to beef it up, and they say, oh, and, you know, by the way, we're going to throw in this airplane because, you know, the royal family's got 3, we only need 2. We understand that you've got a gap in your expectation from Boeing. We know this because we've been in negotiation with Boeing the past 3 months, right? And so it's a nice tie-in. It is a small pittance compared to the overall Boeing purchase. Just very, very small. And so the Qataris probably don't even think that much of it, right? They're just like, yeah, we got this extra airplane. If it greases the palm, if it makes the president feel good, if it solves a little bit of a problem for him, they're thinking all good. And what's the downside? The downside is he says, no, I can't do that. It doesn't look right. Believe me, I was a cop for 11 and a half years. If I had a dime for every time someone wanted to buy me lunch, right, I could buy myself lunch.
Right.
The reason you say no is not because, you know, you're some towering paragon of ethics, and plenty of cops are. I don't mean it like that. But,
right,
you know, once you accept the lunch and then someone turns around and says, oh, Mike took a lunch. Well, why? You know, now what? And now you've compromised yourself over what? You know, a $15 ham sandwich. It just ain't worth it. And I think that that's where these folks are, is that they threw in the airplane, which sounds like a tremendously large gift by American standards to an individual.
Right.
But by the standards of this gigantic Boeing negotiation to the Qataris, it sounds like nothing. And Trump probably, you know, you could imagine him saying, sure. And to your point, that's where the staff has got to step in and say, oh, hey, boss, look, we get it. But, you know, we're not going down this path.
Yeah, and unfortunately, to tie it into something else that we've had an issue with, the president historically has signed the most executive orders for his first 100 days than any president in the history of the United States. He is ruling by executive order, something that, forget libertarians, conservatives and Republicans used to rail about when it came to Obama. Hey, this guy is ruling by executive order. So is Trump. And it's good to see certain Republicans in Congress stand up against it. Massey, Rand Paul have stood up against it and said, hey, you know, all this stuff that you're doing, you can't claim an emergency forever. You know, you can't say immigration's an emergency, trade's an emergency. Everything can't be an emergency. So when you have a president that's ruling by regal decree, it does tend to put most of this stuff that comes up, like this shady-looking plane deal, it does tend to politically put it right at his own feet. Because up until now, you've been ruling on your own. You've been ruling by executive order. You've been having these press conferences where everybody comes and, you know, kisses your boots in front of the TVs to tell you how wonderful you are. And, you know, the big signing ceremonies for every EO. It becomes very hard then to say, well, this was a legislative decision or this was a truly governmental deal. It really does become
more. I agree. And by the way, also to your point, it can't be lost on the Qataris that he is the man, uniquely right. The man, consolidating his power, leading authoritarian method by which he makes decisions. So it makes it a more effective gift. Like, I mean, if you were going to bribe someone, if you're going to bribe an American president, this is the one to bribe, right? Because
yeah,
he's
exactly.
So powerful. You know,
right.
Bribing, I don't know, what's a good counterexample? You know, bribing Lyndon Johnson might not have been quite as effective because his shtick was bullying Congress, right?
Right.
He always had to bring them along.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I see what you mean. How much do you think of this, if first of all, do you think it'll go through where they actually accept the gift of the plane?
I don't think so. I think that there's going to be enough pushback, and I think that if the White House would do, again, they don't do a good job with communication. If they had a separate announcement regarding the Boeing purchase, most Americans don't even know about the Boeing purchase from the Qataris, right? If they would have raised that profile, and they still can, then, you know, this wouldn't seem so large. They'd be able to throw it overboard.
Right.
And it would work out. And in fact, that's how I would get out of it.
Oh, yeah. Just throw it on like this was a business deal.
This was part of a business deal. We're going to get rid of this piece of it. It's only going to go to the American government. It's not going to go to the library, whatever. In fact, you could imagine Boeing stepping up and saying, we figured out a few things to close the gap. You're not going to need the airplane from the Qataris at all.
Right.
There are many ways to get out of this, but they all start with raising the profile of what is actually a fantastic announcement that the White House could be making regarding this sale.
Right.
And by the way, this isn't the only one. We should talk about there's another a weird, almost offhand remark made by the Syrian government.
Right.
Recently that I found odd to the point of potential humor. The Trump administration and the Syrian government are reaching an agreement to drop economic sanctions, right? To
right.
boost trade investment. Again, the Syrian government has traditionally, but over the past couple of decades been close to Moscow. Keeping them from sliding back toward Moscow is a legitimate right. objective for foreign policy for the United States government. They do have this new, probably autocratic leader in Syria who used to be Al-Qaeda. This is a tricky fish to fry, no question about it. And so I give the White House props for, again, to your point, we're worried about the reward coming first as opposed to the reward coming for good behavior. But, you know, that's probably one step of sophistication above where we should be setting the bar for some of these folks.
Sure.
But, you know, good for the effort, right? But then there is this weird offhand remark that came out of the Syrian government that sounded something like the following. And how about Trump Tower in Damascus? Well, okay. Now you've just undermined your announcement because, and I don't know if these things don't translate well. I don't know if these governments don't realize what it's like to operate in a democracy and what the press in the United States is going to do, right? But when you say, you know, and we're thinking about getting a Trump Tower in Damascus. Can you wait 6 months to say that? Can you?
Yeah.
It just makes it look like the whole thing was greased.
Yeah, and again, I don't know what to make of it. Because on one hand, I say to myself, nobody on the U.S. side would be party to something so idiotically transparent, meaning that if you are getting the wheels greased, at least have the common decency not to flaunt it type of thing. You know,
right.
Don't brand it. Yeah, it's like keep your mouth shut. Like if I'm on the take, to use your cop thing, if I'm on the take, I'm not going to walk around with $20 bills falling out of my uniform pocket, right? I'm going to be like, all right, put it in a lockbox somewhere. I'll pick it up once every other week. Like what was that precinct in the 75th precinct? Whichever one it was. I don't mean to malign any good precinct. Yeah, and it's like, come on. So to something like this, you're like, wait a second. But on the other hand, it's not, I mean, I'm trying to be delicate. I don't think it's beyond Trump to say this is just part of being president. I negotiate deals. And if they want to show their gratitude by letting me build a tower somewhere in Damascus, fantastic. You know, what's wrong with that? You know, I'm not doing anything wrong. I could actually see the president's thought process being something similar to that.
Yeah. Agreed.
So why wouldn't someone, again, I think to your point, bad staff work, that someone, if this is going through, someone should go talk to the Syrians and say, okay, this is the script. This is how you will announce it. You know, we'll do this deal. This is how you will announce it. And it's interesting because you're seeing these series of Middle Eastern deals coming through. You mentioned Syria. There's also the whole Saudi Arabia thing where we're basically becoming an arms dealer for Saudi Arabia. Almost $150 billion worth of U.S. Yep. arms going to Saudi Arabia.
A very big deal.
Now, I meant to ask you about this because I'm a little conflicted about it. I'll tell you why. If it's a pure sale where you're like, we've got these arms, we're selling them, I think that's pure free market capitalism. Now, at the same time, I also understand that everyone else in the region views that as very interventionist. Like, okay, we're not putting boots on the ground, but we are clearly taking sides unless we arm everybody equally, or at least give them the opportunity to arm themselves equally. I could see where someone very easily grows up resentful in some whoever Saudi Arabia is picking a fight with, saying like, okay, yeah, the Saudis may have been the ones pulling the trigger, but the Americans were the ones who gave them the guns. And much to what Ron Paul was always saying, why is it that these people then come back with terrorist acts against the U.S.? You know, yeah. And are we thinking far enough ahead, Mike, on something like this?
I agree. It's very complicated. I think that we should not be completely shocked by any of this. The Trump administration 1.0 had initiated in what was truly a triumphant achievement in the Abraham Accords, bringing these nations together for the first time at least in millennia. These nations didn't even exist, until last century. Bringing them together in a relationship that is new, and only in that context were something like this even possible. The Israeli government probably is not all that excited about it, but anything that offsets the Iranian government is a good thing from the standpoint of not only the United States and our interests, but for many, many players in the Middle East in general. And so we all get that. If it helps put pressure on the Iranians and Trump is able to get a better deal than that which he complained about in the Obama administration, then this is all good. By the way, you know, regarding the deal that the Obama, you and I probably should talk about this in a future episode. Regarding the Obama deal, I think that it is probably true that the White House did whatever it could, got as good a deal as it could. I was sympathetic when Barack Obama said, what's the alternative? War. You know, we were all upset that it was only 10 years. We were upset that it wasn't permanent and thereby right. verifiable, and that it gave to the Iranians so much of what it is that they were asking for. But the open-end question was, how are you going to make that better? You know, these are the cards that we have. And I think that for all of the criticism that we heap upon the Trump administration, we need to recognize that the administration does something that other administrations wouldn't do. And that is, they don't merely play the cards that they have. They play cards they don't have. They go get cards, right? They upend the apple cart. They create chaos. I do believe in many cases it's absolutely unintentional. But in some cases, it's a little bit intentional. You know, they think outside the box. The president is certainly not held back by the way business is typically done.
Right.
And developing a relationship with Saudi Arabia the way we have, giving them arms that are far superior to anything that they would get anywhere else,
right,
at a price that's far better for the U.S. military industrial complex than they would get from anyone else. I mean, there's a lot of people calling this a win-win, right?
Right.
That's the kind of deal that is going to change the cards that the president is holding when negotiating with Iran. Because he's going to say, remember the last time we talked, you know, and you didn't want a deal? Well, guess what? Since then, Israel has become stronger. Saudi Arabia has become stronger. All of Europe is becoming stronger. By the way, these are all relative to you, right? Russia is becoming weaker. China is up against it financially, if not militarily. And I just sold 200 airplanes to Qataris. What do you got? Right? He's in a much stronger position than he was in 1.0. And I would not be surprised if at the end of the day he does get a deal with the Iranians and he will point to it and say, Barack Obama never could have done that. And notwithstanding jumping up and down and screaming about ethics, the libertarians, the Democrats, and every Republican is going to have to admit he was right.
Yeah. I don't want to use troubling. But it is cautionary, isn't it? That, I mean, I know you were a little bit tongue-in-cheek when you said that. Like, you know, despite our ethics, we will have to admit that he ended up in the right place. And begrudgingly, I would have to agree with you. But it always does come back to not the slippery slope necessarily, but the ends justifying the means. And at what point do you put your foot down and say, it doesn't? Or it does, you know, I think that's struggling. But perhaps, I guess you could argue, if we're at that point, if that's our only worry is struggling with answering that question, maybe the entire world has moved to a better place, to a better platform upon which to debate that sort of.
Well, that's an interesting point, John, and we will talk about this next week, I'm sure. But it does seem to me that there are a lot of Americans who would say, let me get this straight. We can make the Middle East safer. Make the Iranians behave better, get the Europeans to spend more money to defend themselves so that we can spend less, thereby making our economy stronger. And the price I paid for it is what? To look the other way when Donald Trump took an airplane? Ethically speaking, yeah, you know, we will do us. We will complain. But the real hardcore pragmatist.
Yeah, we'll be like, who cares? Yeah, no, I get it. Well, Mike, like you said, perhaps another episode where we go a little bit more in depth than that. All right. Interesting Liberty Lens this week. I hope you all enjoyed it. Until next time, when I'm once again joined by Mr. Mike Turbat over there, this is Big John. We will catch you next week.